sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Just back from China, and I have a lot to share with you. Greece still stealing the headlines, and markets seeing extreme volatility. All this and much more on episode number 420 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Andrew Horowitz here, and it was a long flight back from China, total of about 26 hours between all the layovers and the flight time, but it was pretty cool. We'll get to that, and I'm going to tell you a lot about the things that I learned in China, not only a few words here and there, some of the important things that you have to know if you're going to go, but also about the culture in terms of some of the things related to the investment markets, because there were some things I really picked up this time. I've been there before. I've been to Asia before, and each time it's important to go because not only do I have some time for vacation, but also learning about what is going on inside the country is very invaluable to do so if you're going to be doing any kind of investing in that area, because understanding the culture and how they think, what they do, how they react is very important. And in China in particular, there's some things that I learned that I thought was very interesting. Before we get to that, we'll spend a little time talking about Greece, because obviously Greece has been in the headlines, and as a matter of fact, they're talking about it over in China. You know, what's the problem with the markets? Greece, 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 Greece. That's all they can talk about. And I thought that was really interesting coming from some of the drivers, some of the people I met on the street, some of the people I met in the hotels, some of the businessmen that I had some opportunity to spend some time with as well. But Greece is stealing the headlines because once again, we have a deadline that seems to have come and gone. It was supposed to be Sunday, and this Sunday, today, when the final judgment on what was going to happen with the plan. Now, just to back it up a little bit, if you recall last week or so, about a week and a half ago, there was that vote. And the vote was, hey, we're going to leave it up to the Greek people. We're going to do a referendum as to whether or not we're going to go along with the austerity measures. And we're going to go along with what we have to do by contract while we got the money, you know, back in 2010. I think, again, in 2012 with the bailout money and all the things that we're supposed to be doing with the pension reform, taxes, spending, and things that weren't done by Greece. They didn't hold up their end of the bargain. But they didn't care because, you know what, screw this, they said. We're going to throw this right out the window. People voted, said no. Overwhelmingly, we are not going to go along with this anymore. It's hurting us. We're going to try to do it in another measure, and maybe our creditors will help us out by cutting down some of the debt we owe, maybe the interest rate, maybe some of the terms, maybe even relieve some of the debt that we have outstanding. And what was really fascinating was right after that vote, just immediately following that vote, where the current party that was anti-austerity got everything they wanted, what happened? The most vocal party in the entire process, who was the finance minister, Varoufakis, you remember that name we've talked about before, the game theory mastermind, the one that was very abrasive, the one that was constantly throwing barbs and comments and name-calling all the Euro members about how they were, how they were, you know, really targeting and trying to break the backs of the Greeks and all this stuff. He got his way. Yeah, the Greek people voted. Resounding agreement that, you know what? We are not going to put up with this anymore. And what happened? He resigns. Now, you got to think about that for a second. Why would the individual who was so for all these austerity measures, was pressing to, you know, get them to have some relief, and everything that they wanted, they got, Why did he resign? It's a bit of a mystery, isn't it? But clearly what has transpired since that actual referendum went through where he resigned, now all of a sudden Greece is saying, hey, you know what? Well, we didn't really mean it. We really want a bailout. We need like 70 or 80 billion euros. And we're going to go along with the austerity, even though we had this referendum, even though we've been stalling, even though we've been telling you we're not going to go along with this, even though we got the permission and Parliament agreed to all this, the people voted, okay, we'll go along with more austerity now. It is kind of mind-blowing. If you really think about and track all the things that have gone on, each and every step of the way, Greece has come to the front of the line saying they don't want this, pressed Europe to the edge, to the precipice, even went so far as allowing the country in total, the masses, the voters, to vote on it individually to get permission so that in the event something went wrong, well, they're not to blame, you know, Tsipras and Varoufakis and all the members of the anti-austerity party weren't to blame. It would be, hey, this is the will of the people. And then only a couple days later, they are starting to go along with, oh, okay, we'll go with more austerity, which I got to tell you something is unbelievable. And it just shows you that these guys are amateurs, absolute amateurs. They are pros at well, I guess we could say lying, of twisting, of trying their best to make this situation appear that they're doing what is in the best interest of the Greek people, but at the same time, somehow, really screwing it up royally. The fact that Varoufakis has resigned and now they're going for more austerity, I am hoping that the European governors and all the members see through this very, very ill-planned program of constantly trying to stall, twist, and confound any logic that can be utilized in this whole process. Greece has become a total joke, in my opinion, in terms of not the way that the impact that whether they stay in or they leave has, but in the respect of the process. They have bastardized this process, and they have made everyone in it look like absolute fools. And now they are asking for more money. Now, meanwhile, the deadline for Sunday for them to come up with a program and for everybody to agree once again is delayed. 72 more hours has been allotted for them to come up with a better plan because the plan they came up with was okay, but there was no teeth in it. And one of the big things that happened was that over the last number of years, when money was given to Greece, they did not abide by the rules of the game. And some of the program they did, of course, and they had austerity there, and they did some of the things they were supposed to, but they still have not abided by all of the letters of the program that was put in place when they borrowed billions of dollars. So how can you now, and if you really think about it, why doesn't Greece just say, okay, you know what? All right, we give in. We haven't followed along with the plan so far. Give us another $80 billion, but you know, this time we promise we're really going to go along with things. Their markets have been closed for over a week. Their banks have been closed. They are on capital controls. They're only 60 euros per withdrawal from the ATMs are allowed. Their ATMs are running dry. It's a real problem. Their banks need about $20 billion of recapitalization. And they're sitting there probably laughing hysterically about how they made all of these European leaders jump through hoops and then say, oh, we promise we'll do it. Don't worry about it. And the fact is that it seems that this Sunday deadline, even though it's delayed a few days, and that deadline will be delayed a few more days also, is showing the weakness of the Eurozone and the fact that they do not want a Greek exit. Now, there's been some talk, but Schäuble, I believe his name is, in Germany. A lot of names are hard to pronounce. But Germany has clearly stated that maybe it's a good idea for a, quote-unquote, temporary exit of Greece from the euro. A trial. We'll see what happens. Let's see how it works. But this way, they can have both feet in. On one side, they have the foot in where, well, they're kind of not in the euro, but we'll still help them out and give them support. And if it doesn't work out, we'll boot them. And on the other hand, well, they'll give them support if it works out. And if they start doing reform, maybe in a few months, because they're on temporary double secret probation here, of course, right? You know, maybe we'll bring them back in. Anything to save their asses. That's the bottom line here. It doesn't matter if it's the right thing to do or not. It's just the panic that is going on right now because they realize that this whole thing is starting to potentially spread to Europe, areas such as Italy and Portugal, maybe even Spain. And they're seeing that they can be pushed around pretty easily, and they don't want that. I would venture to say this thing is going to last for some time more than is being seen right now. And each and every little hiccup in the program is seeing markets react very strongly. We saw that on the heels of the referendum, markets sold off dramatically. They came back a little bit in the U.S., of course, on that. You know, they couldn't keep it down too much here, but it's like, oh, you know, what does this really have to do with Greece? What is the U.S. market? You know, we don't really get a lot of import-export from them and all. But still, it is affecting a lot of the markets around the world. So we're going to keep a watch on that. Now that there was that non-event that everybody was hoping for, or at least hoping for an event over the weekend that would resolve all this, and things were getting closer, but Greece finally taking their medicine and taking the money, getting the bailout done, and the most recent bailout, and everything is going to be just patched up over the weekend, and now we have this again. So we'll see what happens. Futures will show probably a red mark going into the opening on Monday. Clearly, there is a lot of disappointment over the fact that they didn't get anything done. So we'll have to see how that plays out. Want to talk a little bit about China, a little bit about some of the things that we did over there. I attended some cooking classes. That was kind of fun. I had a good time doing that. And, you know, there was a significant amount of traveling. I think we covered about 1,800, 1,900 miles between planes and trains and all the different areas we went. Went up to the mountains. That was just amazing, breathtaking. Down south and in Yangzhou. Started out the trip over in Chengdu. This is the heart of Sichuan province. And I got to tell you, you know, you've eaten probably Sichuan food in Chinese restaurants. It's kind of hot and spicy. You have no idea how much red pepper they put in everything, between the red pepper chili oil, between the red peppers. It is amazing. As a matter of fact, we took a cooking class there. There was one particular dish that we were making that we couldn't breathe because the red peppers and the chili oil that we're cooking was fuming up. And even though there was an exhaust, it was so intense, it was impossible to breathe. We had to leave the room. But spicy upon spicy, they have these hot pots where you take this sliced meat and vegetables and fish and chicken and pork, and you put it into this boiling, watery, hot chili pepper kind of broth that's right in the middle of your table. They bring this whole concoction to your table. But the food was quite amazing, very inexpensive. Taxis were very inexpensive. Just everything, the beers, just really a great area to be in Chengdu. Then we head down to Xi'an. I had the best crawfish, this giant pile of crawfish in this brown spicy sauce on the street. All of a sudden what happens is at nighttime, the stores open. They put out tables on the sidewalk and into the street, and the whole street is packed with all these restaurants serving. Quite amazing. Saw some interesting traditional Chinese shows. One of the shows that we saw in that area, a little bit actually in Yangzhou, was if you watched the 2008 Beijing Olympics, remember the opening ceremonies where they had that incredible show of dancers and acrobats and all of that at the in Beijing at the Bird's Nest, they called it. And the gentleman who choreographed all of that actually has a show that he started before that. I think he started back in 2004 in Yangzhou. And it is at night. It's in the middle of these unbelievable mountains that are created by limestone erosion, we'll call it. And if you haven't seen it, you should take a look. Just look up Yangzhou mountainside or landscape. Beautiful arches and just incredible mountainous area that has been carved out by the Li River, I believe it is, the Dragon River. And it's just a really cool background. Well, all of this in the middle of this river where a couple of rivers meet right there. I believe it's the Lee River and the Dragon River meet. And there's this area where you sit and you watch 600 performers that are in the water on these bamboo rafts at night. So it's kind of things are floating by. And they take and do all these things with light and light up the mountains. Really quite incredible. So that's down in Yangzhou. And from there, went down to Guangzhou. You know what? There's all these Zhaos going on here. Let me think where we went to. Yeah, the last part of the trip. Now, it's the third most populated city in China, I believe, between Beijing, Shanghai, and Guangzhou. Someone who knows how to pronounce words in Chinese that's listening better than I, please do not be too frustrated that I'm butchering all these. And one of the things we did learn, by the way, speaking of trying to pronounce words is, well, two things. First, each of the provinces and areas, just like in the United States to a degree, has a different dialect and accent on the words, and very difficult. For example, when we were up in the area of Chengdu, when you talk about the currency, the yuan, well, they told us the way they pronounce it is kind of a yuan. Where we go down south, they said it's yuan. It's a yuan. So yuan. And yuan, I don't know. That's how they told us. We were kind of practicing that one word all week. The important words that we learned, xie xie, which is thank you. Ni hao, which is hello, welcome. And the big one, bing pi xiu. That was probably the most important words that we had to commit to memory. And if you're thinking what it is, it's no, it's not where is the bathroom. It means cold beer. Trying to get cold beer. I actually took some pictures of beer on my iPhone and other things on my iPhone so I could reference those when people were wondering what I was trying to ask, because the mannerisms are different. The gestures are much different. The whole way of being and the way of trying to explain things, even in a pantomime form, is so much different in Asia. It's incredible. If you think about it, you could almost, if you didn't talk to somebody in the U.S., try to explain what you were talking about in some kind of a crazy unknown sign language. You can get away with it. But there, it's much different. They have no idea what you're saying. If I was trying to say very simply, give me the bill. You know, kind of you take your hand on one hand and you take the other one and you make it look like a pencil scribing across a piece of paper. And here in the United States, they know what you're talking about. It's easy. But there, they're like, what are you talking about? Do you want to write me a letter? What is that? Do you need a phone number? It's just, they have no idea. They look at you like you have four heads. And it's a very big difference in the culture as well. One of the things that was interesting was when we talked about markets a bit, different people, one of the things they said was, oh, people are going to get out. Nobody's going to get back in. They're going to keep on selling. There's no support because they are, you know, scared. You know, what went on with last few weeks with the Chinese markets, particularly the smaller markets, the Shanghai, the Shenzhen, you know, down about 35% or so in the last several weeks, about $3.9 trillion worth of market cap and total value was erased from those markets. And while I was over there, the Chinese government made the ultimate allowance for market stabilization that was probably the stupidest thing I've ever seen in my life. What the markets did was allow for companies to voluntarily halt their stock. And what that did was create even more illiquidity in the markets and more panic, whereas the stocks that were not halted, people were concerned they would halt and therefore was selling those like crazy. It also created the problem for people, for example, in the U.S. who were involved in stocks in China looking for hedges, having to find other areas so they would use ETFs. And that really caused a lot of problem as well because it hit the whole market. Well, about 70% of the stocks were halted at one point. I think it's maybe 55 or 60 right now. But about 70% of the stocks were halted at one point while I was in China. And as I was reviewing the information and talking about things, doing research while I was over there, I realized that this is a much different market environment. It's a herd mentality. They're very much involved and entrenched in the kind of what everybody else does will do. Now, that's different than the trend tracking. That's different than momentum, even though it may look the same. but it's very much like, oh, what everybody else is doing, I'm going to do. Now, one of the big things that happened was, if you recall, I talked about this several weeks ago, and I've been talking about shorting the Chinese market for a while, so hopefully you took advantage. We actually closed our short position for about a 30% gain last week. We flipped it over to a long, made about, I think it was 15% on the long, and now we are completely out of any positioning in the Chinese markets for the time being. But one of the things that has happened is that this herd really started getting a little crazy with the margin and leveraging up their markets and stock investments, not knowing what they were doing. Millions upon millions of retail investors opening up accounts. We talked about this, remember? And remember I talked about one of the things that really concerned me was the fact that people were putting off buying cars. They said, you know what, we're not going to buy a car right now. We're going to take our money and we're going to actually invest it in the stock market because everybody's just making so much money. And we'll just make money and then we'll take the money out. We'll buy a car then. What happened is that the last in, the people that were doing the high leverage and the high levels of margin, speculating on the fact that there's easy money to be made, lost a ton of money. And now the projections already for car sales in China have been slashed dramatically just a couple of days ago. And this is on the heels of what's gone on with the fact that all these people are losing money. And I would tend to agree with some of the people that I was talking to over there that, hey, you know what? The selling's not over, even though we did see a reversal and some better news due to the Greece situation. We saw the Shanghai pop up about 10% or so in a couple of days. The Hang Seng, the Hong Kong market, also moved higher in a few days. And that was great, but it looked like a little bit more of a just a simple bounce than a realization that, oh, let's put more money in there. People are genuinely scared now, and rightfully so, because they didn't know what they were doing. They didn't understand the risk. They took all this money on margin, kept on plowing it in, and still, even with this major drop that we saw and a lot of the selling that went on and the drop in the margin in terms of the sales and the forced selling that happened, there's still a lot of margin sitting out there, tremendous amount of margin to total market capitalization of the Shanghai and Shenzhen. So keep an eye on Chinese markets. You know, you combine that with the situation with Greece and how it feeds off of each other. And the fact that in China, they have this herd mentality. I think it's something to be watched very carefully. The other thing that I thought was really interesting about the Chinese culture was that they're very much into status. So when I talked to a few people, we talked about like, okay, so what is important and how do you in business show that, you know, maybe get new clients, expand a business. And I'm not talking about your big business. I'm talking about just your average, you know, individuals that are starting out or mid-sized businesses. You know, a car is an important thing. You have a good car, a fancy car. People think, oh, you're doing really well. You have a nice watch. You have an iPhone. You have certain types of things, very materialistic and very status-oriented, very status-driven, at least to show that they have things. And whether or not they do or don't, it's all about showing and showing the outward appearance that you're successful, whether or not you are or not. And maybe their success can be gauged by their level of, quote-unquote, theoretical status, their outward status. So that was interesting. And the other thing that was really fascinating was, and horrifying at the same time, was that we were driving through Chengdu and Xi'an, and Xi'an in particular. Do you know the stories that we've talked about the ghost housing, the ghost apartments, ghost cities? And there's been some, they're building it, but people are going to move in. And, you know, the only reason why they're not filled right now is because, you know, they're not finished. They're finishing it now. And then eventually people will move in and you move on, and what you're really only seeing is the newest things that are being built, so don't pay any attention to that. Oh, no. I got to tell you something. Miles and miles and miles of gigantic half-done buildings or buildings that are semi-completed but not occupied and new buildings going up at an incredible pace. It is astonishing. You can't imagine what I'm telling you, but just think of these 50-story buildings, apartment buildings, 20 or 30 of them in a block, in a bunch, all of them unoccupied, all over the place. I mean, you drive down a road and it's just ghost city after ghost city after ghost city. And then new apartments going up in the same situation going to happen just down the street. So what's happening and why is this going on? Well, the government, first of all, thought that it would be stimulative to build all this and have construction and, you know, build and get the glass for the windows and aluminum for the various railings and metals and copper for the wiring and toilet bowls and sinks and, you know, go on and on of the list that would be what would happen if you had all this building going on. And theoretically, all the people that were going to be building these properties would be moving towards the city from the farmlands and suburbs, et cetera, and then they eventually move in. Problem is the apartments are too expensive. They can't afford it. The second thing is that this is a way for the government officials to skim off the top, and we know that this has been going on for years, whereas the governments, the officials would approve these properties, get kickbacks, and also, you know, push the business in certain areas into certain relatives, into certain businesses that they own themselves, and therefore providing a significant amount of profit for them. Now, the government has been cracking down on this. And because of that, we have seen that, well, not much has gone on to that side. They're still building, but at least there is some kind of a slowdown. And much of that slowdown is reflective in the fact that, I guess that, you know, there may not be as much of this going on, but they're still in the mindset that, hey, people will move into these things. I don't see it. It seems a little bit impossible to fill all of the apartments, even with the 1.5 billion people that live in China. But each of these towns, I'm not just talking about one town, by the way. I mean, I was in driving through various cities to get to different cities along the way, whether it was from Chengdu down to Xi'an, you know, driving all around these places or flying in. Flying over is just unbelievable. The sight is astonishing. The ghost cities are not just one little area, you know, a couple of them here and there. They're everywhere. Now, maybe what will happen is in 3 years, 2 years, 5 years, the next industry will be breaking these things down just to build them up again and the thought that it will help the economy. But the truth of the matter is there is a massive amount of overbuilding going on, and there's going to be a big problem. That's why the Chinese government has had to step in so many times to help the banks, because all these people who floated loans to try to build these buildings and the developers, et cetera, have no revenue coming in after the fact. Now, why they're letting them continue to build, even though all these other buildings are unoccupied, is a mystery. It could only be to do with something whereas there is a, I guess, an inside deal for the government officials. It's the only thing that I could think of. Because why else would they allow this to go on? So just something to think about. China is clearly, in my opinion, a bit more fragile than they're letting on. And from what I've seen and from what I've heard, from what I've researched, and now the topper with this whole ghost city situation, I think we've got to be very careful of what's really going on there. I think that there's rightfully a reason to be concerned about their GDP slowing down. And the fact, and if the truth really is that there is, you know, all these very poorly executed government stimulus plans and very similar to the poorly executed market measures that they made worse by allowing more margin, pulling it back, then allowing for companies to halt, then providing more margin and leverage availabilities, and then pushing more money in. And I just, there's no confidence left. The confidence really has left the whole China region. From, I think, a lot of the insiders and people there, they understand that there's really is a house of cards, so to speak. But I think a lot of people on the outside looking in don't have the right image of really what's happening there. And they're really just seeing things on paper and ignoring the facts that are really truly out there. Well, we're going to end it early and very short this week. I'm rather exhausted, running about 12 hours on the other side, so going to try to get some rest, get back to normal here for the week coming up. I will have some great guests coming on. We'll talk more about some of these situations, also post some pictures on the website and Twitter, and keep an eye on all the things we've mentioned, particularly on China through either the ETFs or some of the stocks underlying it. Be careful because there are a lot of companies that are going private right now. So if you're going to be shorting any of the stocks, I prefer you look at the ETFs these days, Yin, Yang, ASHR, a couple of those to take a look at, FXI as well. So until next week, thanks again for joining me, and thanks again for being patient with my little vacation schedule this summer, and I will talk to you and see you next week. Thanks again. Jason.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.